Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, it's so hot outside again. I didn't even look this time and try to match a wine with a film. I just grabbed a rosé and threw it in the fridge. It's called Rezac. And that's all I know. I actually don't care. I just felt like drinking something cold.
Well, and it's very muggy out there, and it looks like it's about to storm any minute now. So being inside, doing a podcast, and drinking a glass of rosé, not a bad deal.
We're going to talk about six films on this podcast, but we each only saw five of the six. And you do something very rare on this podcast. You and you alone saw the blockbuster. Yes. I did not see the Marvel film, Spider-Man Homecoming, so you've got some heavy lifting, Hannah.
Yeah, and your presence was missed at this one. I know that you suffer from superhero fatigue a lot.
I'm tired of Spider-Man reboots.
And so I think this one might have been a little painful for you. It's very good. It's just I don't think we needed it. But since we have it, it's actually pretty decent. It's a Spider-Man for a new generation. I mean, you've never seen...
They're still the same generation from the old reboot.
Well, it's a little strange, but I think this one, because it's part of... It's a Spider-Man that is already now part of the Avengers world. It makes for a more entertaining and a new twist on Spidey. And so I think that's why it's going to work. I think if he didn't have the Avengers universe going for it, then this would just be yet another reboot that we do not need. But we need it only because of the future Avengers movies, of which this particular Spider-Man character will continue to be a part of.
Do they effectively tie it in? Spider-Man, like we've already saw him. They introduced him in Captain America's Civil War. He took sides with Iron Man in that one, Tony Stark, against Captain America. Now in his own movie, in his own narrative, do they tie him in okay?
They do. And the way they tie it in is he's basically this particular Spider-Man played by Tom Holland, an English actor, another British actor they get to play Spider-Man, plays this, 15-year-old teen in high school, but he's just come off his battling with alongside the Avengers and with Tony Stark. And so the way they tie it all together is that this kid, this particular Peter Parker, has an internship with Stark Enterprises. And so Tony Stark is still a presence in this film, kind of the watchful eye mentor of Spider-Man as he is growing into his superpowers and understanding what comes with that. And Iron Man / Tony Stark has made this Spider-Man an Iron Man-ish type of suit, like a better, more powerful suit. So the idea is that, to me, this particular Spider-Man played like Smallville on TV, where you were watching Superman, the Clark Kent in his teenage years, dealing with high school issues at the same time that he's trying to grow into his superpowers. That was on the small screen. Here you have on the big screen, Peter Parker dealing with high school issues, trying to navigate high school as well as his emerging superpowers. And he's, got the adrenaline rush going from having been with the Avengers. He's like an Avengers in training. And so this is about him trying to prove himself as a full-fledged Avenger and to get Tony Stark to kind of, move him up the chain. But he's still a kid. And it's a Spider-Man kid who is overeager. He's, trying to ask, he's got the homecoming dance coming out. Thus the homecoming subtitle, which is meant to be like it's Spider-Man's homecoming to the Marvel universe, as well as the more overt homecoming dance that becomes integral to this movie.
Is it as good as 94% on the tomato meter, tied right now for the highest ever superhero film?
I'll tell you, you know, I talked with our buddy Travis Hobson last week about Spider-Man on his podcast as a guest only. And he loved this movie and loved the Spider-Man and disagreed with me that we just didn't need it. And so there is definitely a subset of people, the fanboys who love the comics and who love this world. And he was all over it. And he felt that it was definitely a great movie. Possibly some people think it's the best Spider-Man yet. I just didn't feel that. And
that
I
would be
it
tough
was,
to beat Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, the first and second, you know, and I was missing Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man again. And it's weird to roll back the clock. And when you have this history of the Spider-Man character and of Peter Parker as an older person, it's weird to have this millennial age Spider-Man. He is, you know, he's like a aspiring YouTuber versus a Daily Bugle photographer. And so it is a modern day reboot of this character. And I liked it. I think anybody who's an Avengers fan should still go and see it. It, you know, it's integral to the future movies, but I just felt like I certainly could have lived without it.
It's not Spider-Man unless there's an editor in the Daily Bugle chomping on a cigar going, I need pictures of Spider-Man on my desk by 5 o'clock.
And there's none of that. This is a completely different, this is like if Spider-Man maybe was like working for BuzzFeed or something, then maybe, but it's a Spider-Man who knows how to take a selfie.
See, I don't want my Spider-Man Snapchat. To have an Instagram account.
Exactly.
I don't.
This is a Spider-Man who will have an Instagram account.
Boo.
And, you know, there were some fun inside jokes. Okay, so it was fun to see Tony Stark when he would just sort of pop up. Captain America has some hysterical little vignettes throughout this movie. He pops up basically doing PSAs in the kids' high school, you know, stay in school type of things. And so that was fun. And then you had Michael Keaton was the villain Vulture in this film. And
Birdman?
Birdman. So it was kind of, there's lots of like little wink, wink, nudge, nudge moments in this entire universe of superhero movies. And so I think having Michael Keaton in that role was kind of funny. But he, it's an interesting role for him. He's sort of a not such a terrible guy turned into a bad guy because of circumstances of the economy and things like that. So, you know, overall, I mean, I can't, it's a much more, I would say, diverse type of cast. You've got the girlfriend the girl that Peter's interested in asked the homecoming dance.
I hope her name is Mary Jane.
No. So her name is not Mary Jane. I think it's like Liz. But there's a nod to the potential future relationship that he may be involved in. So no, he's not at the Mary Jane relationship yet. But it's more of a, again, it's an interesting take on this iconic character, and it's perfectly entertaining for what it is. It's like a John Hughes, you know, Breakfast Club meets superhero movie. It's different, and they're going to like it. It's just the kind of movie where it's hard to come out and really not like it on some level. It's entertaining, but you have to be one of those superhero fans. If you are not already, and there's no way that you should be seeing this one if you have not yet seen Wonder Woman. Wonder Woman, to me, is still the stronger of the two and should be seen first.
I disagree. You should not be seeing any of these unless you've seen Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, but, you know, I love the Avengers movies. They're fun. And again, you know that if it's a Marvel movie, you have to stay through the very, 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 very end of the end credits.
Do they get you again a couple times?
They get you. There are two post-credit scenes. And so you need to stick around. And it gives you just that last laugh, actually, that helps you leave the theater with a smile on your face.
It's always good to know there's something in the credits, because every now and then I'll stay through them and, I just wasted 12 minutes of special effects names for nothing.
This is Marvel. You knew you were getting it.
Oh, absolutely. Well, our next film is just another reason in a very long line of reasons that I don't watch trailers. Because going into this, I thought the journey was going to be very dry, very just political discourse, back and forth, maybe some flashbacks. And boy, was I wrong. This kept me riveted, even though it's just two guys in the back of a van talking. It's about the Troubles, Northern Ireland, for the last 40 years, and it's about the peace talks that happened in 2006 in Scotland. I was living in England at the time, and I vaguely remember this going on, but I didn't have stakes in it. You know, I wasn't British, I wasn't Irish, I wasn't Scottish. I didn't care. But this movie would make you care. Caveat, you need to know something about Northern Ireland going into the journey. You don't necessarily need to know who Dr. Ian Paisley is or Martin McGuinness is, but you need to know that the conflict is Catholic versus Protestant, that they hate each other, and that they hate each other going back a long way, and that atrocities have been committed on both sides. You need to know that and have a foundation to really understand this film. And man, this film knocked my socks off, Hannah. And I didn't know who was playing Ian Paisley until the end. I thought, wow, this actor is really good. He's so good. I can't wait to find out who it is. It's Timothy Spall, hidden under makeup and bad teeth.
A lot of makeup, yeah.
I couldn't believe it was Timothy Spall, one of the world's greatest actors. He was my favorite actor from a couple years ago when he played J.M.W. Turner in Mr. Turner. Timothy Spall is amazing, and he's so good in this one. I didn't recognize him as Dr. Ian Paisley, and his counterpart is Colm Meaney, playing Martin McGuinness, the IRA figure. What a fascinating film, Hannah. I have to ask, do you agree with anything I've just said?
Well, I do. Unfortunately, I actually do agree with you to a large part. I was not as over the moon about this film as you were, but I did find it fascinating. Just sort of, you're kind of a fly on the wall. But what's important to realize that this is, it unfolds like a stage play, and it's historical fiction. And so if you liked like watching Fences and things like that, then that's the kind of pacing that you're going to get and the kind of acting that you're going to get. And I don't think if you had anyone other necessarily than these two really solid character actors in those lead roles, I'm not sure this movie would have worked as well. I agree. I only read the synopsis just before watching it. I had no idea what this film was going to be about either. I did not watch any trailer. And it's also a bit like a Frost Nixon.
I thought about Frost Nixon, yeah.
I thought about Frost Nixon. I also thought about the Queen. And the reason I thought about the Queen is I thought if there's one thing that I did not particularly like about this film, it was the casting
of Tony Blair.
So this guy, Toby Stevens, is Tony Blair. All I kept thinking was Michael Sheen played this role in The Queen and was a believable Tony Blair.
And this is I could see the tie into The Queen. He plays Tony Blair just as he's twitchy.
It caricature-ish. You know, in the way that he's played. I didn't like that portrayal, the way it was portrayed. But I think it's important to realize that this entire film is an imagining, other than the basic facts that these two got together for peace talks in 2006, and the setup, which was that Paisley was celebrating his 50th wedding anniversary and needed to get back home for the celebrations. And McGuinness was like, well, I'll have to fly home with you, because there was some sort of unspoken rule at the time that leaders of opposing parties needed to fly together to basically dissuade one side or the other from trying to assassinate somebody. And so that part was all true, and we know that that happened, and we know that they reached agreement. But the whole journey that these guys are on is a fictional imagining of what the conversations between those two on the plane or getting to the airport might have been like, but we don't know. And it's probably way funnier and entertaining and absorbing and dramatic in its way with the scripting. Then you know, it's important to remember that this is not it's not a biopic. It's sort of somebody going, I wonder what that conversation, how that went, and kind of imagining, creating that dialogue.
You mentioned laughter. There's some humor in this, and it's disconcerting to hear Ian Paisley laugh, how Timothy Spall has him laugh.
Yeah, it was weird.
It's like if Voldemort laughed. You know, these guys are not, unlike Tony Blair, these guys are not characters. They are three-dimensional beings with a very profound dramatic structure. And I wanted to point out two supporting roles that are, I think, just, they work very well. The head of MI5, who kind of orchestrated the van ride, is played by the very recently deceased John Hurt, mm-hmm. Mr. Elephant Man himself. He was very good. Mm-hmm. And also the driver of the van, who's just, you can tell he's kind of prodding the two older guys to talk to one another, is the grown-up Freddie Highmore, the kid from Finding Neverland and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, has grown up into, he must be in his mid-20s now. Wow, Freddie Highmore's still around.
I know, and I'm watching this guy in this scene thinking, he looks so familiar.
Yeah, where
have I seen this guy? That driver looks really familiar. Where have I seen him before? And then when I saw his name in the end credits, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's Freddie Highmore. I love Finding Neverland. To me, that was like, that was just such a great role for him. I think I even saw him in that movie, August Rush, which was a tearjerker from years back. So from his younger days. And it's nice to see that he's kind of growing into, definitely a more mature actor, and he held his own in this. And so I did like that. Again, I think the performances elevated the movie beyond what it might otherwise have been. It's a slow to unfold, very quiet. Everything is focused really on the dialogue between these two men. And I think those moments of levity, just when they're trying to break the ice, or I think I came off liking McGinnis came off, I think, more as the person who was really trying to break through and decided that this is our time, that we need to stop this fighting, stop the bloodshed, and step up and figure out a way to make peace. And if he had given up any easier, then the whole thing probably would have fallen apart. So I actually felt that the movie made him slightly more sympathetic.
He is. Paisley's made out as the more cantankerous guy. He's older, and you learn a lot about Ian Paisley. Americans don't know this guy. We do not know who he is unless you've kind of studied this in college. I had no idea. He stood up in the middle of the European Parliament and called the Pope the Antichrist, and he thinks the European Union is this vast conspiracy to convert all of Europe into a Catholic state. He's kind of like the Donald Trump of Northern Ireland a little bit. He comes off as very non-negotiable and kind of a hard ass.
Yeah, and they set the stage early on that it's like, why now? Why these two men? And when you've had 40 years of fighting and thousands of people dying, you know, what's the difference? And essentially the way they set it up is that I think they said something, young men fight for the hell of it, old men care about their legacy. And so it was about these two men trying to overcome their past and being willing to forge a legacy for themselves. And they did. And so when you realize that the final, like the outcome is true, so you know what happened after these 2006 talks. And so you know that they formed a successful ruling, you know, governing relationship. And that Northern Ireland has, you know, been at relative peace since their accord. The only face that I think most people realize and remember in relation to this entire story is Gerry Adams. And so when he walks into the scene,
everybody knows that's Gerry Adams.
You go, okay, that's Gerry Adams. Like that one, he just looked exactly like somebody who was made to look like Gerry Adams. But I think he's the one that most people had connected with Sinn Féin and with the IRA and all of that. And so I think it was interesting for anyone like me who really wasn't aware of the nitty-gritty, the details of how the peace came about and who exactly these other two men were. It was just a very interesting watch.
Well, on one hand, I'm very happy someone, a filmmaker and a distributor, took the plunge on this and gave it a chance. The next film, I have no idea how it got made. I can't imagine how this got made. It's by a writer-director named Jeff Baena. Back in 2004, he wrote a very risky script that was funny at times but didn't really work, called I Heart Huckabees, that critics still talk about to this day. 2014, he did something with Aubrey Plaza called Life After Beth. I think she was a zombie. And now, this is so strange. He grafts 21st century dialogue and problems onto nuns – in 14th century Italy. And this is an adaptation. This is an adaptation of a 14th century collection of novellas, really, by a man named Giovanni Boccaccio. There's like 100 tales in this. It's called the Decameron. So I guess he selected a few of these tales to tell this story. And at first, I didn't watch the trailer. So the first 4 minutes, I was like, oh no, I see these nuns and it's slow and she's walking this donkey forever. And they are the most foul-mouthed, crude, over-the-top nuns you've ever met. They're played by Alison Brie, Aubrey Plaza, and Kate Micucci. And the whole cast are comedians you know, you will recognize. And it's very insular. Two of them are from Saturday Night Live. Two of them are from Parks and Recreation. Two of them were in Band-Aid, that movie we saw like 3 weeks ago.
Oh, right.
They shot it in Tuscany. There's some money behind this. But it doesn't work.
It's weird.
It doesn't... It should work. The talent involved in this and the possibilities are endless. But it's like they had one long weekend of like, what if we did this? What if we did that? And Hannah, it didn't work for me.
It did not work for me at all. It was one that I stuck it out, even though after the first 15 minutes, I kept waiting to see where this bizarre comedy was going. It's a raunchy convent comedy. It's sort of like they were trying to be some weird combination of Gallivant and Monty Python and throw all those like period pieces together. I think the reason it got made, you wonder how it got made. I think there's like relationships between everybody. Like the director was married to one of the stars and two of the other stars were married. And so I think they all just said, let's go to Tuscany. Let's shoot this thing and let's just have fun with it. I think they had way more fun shooting it than we had watching it. It's got John C. Reilly. I mean, who doesn't love John C. Reilly as like a drunk priest who is, you know, trying to, I don't even know what exactly he was trying to do, but he somehow manages to bring Dave Franco into the fold. And he's this day laborer who has to pretend to be deaf and mute so as not to get into any kind of relationship with these nuns, because they're basically sex-starved nuns who then jump his bones. And you've got modern-day dialogue in a 14th century setting, which is supposed to be funny, but the whole thing was just bizarre.
There are some very famous names that just pop up in here. Paul Reiser, Nick Offerman, Molly Shannon. And the one who worked for me, the one guy who worked for me who thought, that's funny, you're playing the same character you always play, but you're still funny, brother, Fred Armisen, comes in as the bishop at the end just to kind of clean up the mess. And he gets this one speech where he's doling out the punishments and he's naming off the sins. And it's hysterical. I went back after this and watched the trailer, and of course, he's most of the trailer because he's the funniest guy in the movie. He's like, eating blood? I've never had to write this down before as a sin. Eating blood? Witchcraft? You're not even baptized? You know?
Yeah.
He's hysterical.
Yeah, no, he was very funny. I mean, individually, there's funny moments in this film. And individually, there are some good performances. It's just collectively, this whole thing of medieval nuns who are suddenly like... in these raunchy scenarios and spying on one another. They're just waiting for a break in their routine. And when Dave Franco's character comes into the picture, that's the break that they needed. It's like substance abuse and horniness and cultish stuff going on. And it's just a few people will find this movie hilarious. I can guarantee it.
And normally I think I would have. I love foul-mouthed nuns and sex-starved nuns and horniness, Hannah, as you all those things you just described. That's my kind of film. And even I don't like this movie.
Yeah, it's like a period drama set in a modern comedy. And it just didn't work. And the fact that it's loosely based on the Decameron by 14th century Italian author that... I've never heard of that guy.
Well,
I'm sorry.
Some people do study this guy in college.
So if you've studied Giovanni Boccaccio... chances are you or Boccaccio, chances are you are going to get a heck of a lot more out of this film. So, you know, if 14th century Italian literature and was more your speed, then by all means, and you like Monty Python, and you like something like Gallivant, and maybe like Robin Hood type stuff, and, you know, then
but like Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Yes. But then maybe you will be one of those few that can appreciate what they achieved here. But for the most part, I just don't know anyone personally who would like this movie.
Well, you mentioned Monty Python, so I'm going to use it as my transition. And now for something completely different. The first of two documentaries we're going to talk about. This one is sobering. It is reality in your face, visuals you don't get to see on the news, because no one can get this footage. Only people on the ground experiencing this day by day are able to film this, and we are in the central, south central desert of Iraq in the not good years, the years where the U.S. was pulling out and ISIS started to move in. It's called Nowhere to Hide. It's from a director called Zardasht Ahmed. But as I was just telling you earlier, I don't know how, you know, he only gets the director's credit probably because he edited it. He didn't film it. He went to the desert and he did something he did in Afghanistan. He found some local medics and gave him a camera and said, I can't stay here. It's not safe. Here's a camera. I'll be back in a couple years. Good luck. And he gave the camera to a man named Nuri in a small village called Jalala. This is played AFI Docs. I didn't see it there. Because, mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, I'm glad I didn't see it there. It just would have gotten lumped in with all the rest. It's, Nuri has a tough couple of years. It's formidable. I didn't find it as profound, I think, as some people did. Anne Hornaday in The Post gave it 4 stars.
Yeah.
And I think you might have liked it a bit more than I did. Tell me about that.
No, I think, I don't think I necessarily liked it more than you did. I think I'm probably on par with your take on it. But I found it really interesting. It really does what a traditional documentary is really meant to do. It is documenting the existence of this guy who started out, he's, you know, a father of four, he's a husband, he's got his family. They're in the middle of this war zone. The whole, what really sets it up is that it starts filming at right after the American troops pull out. And so you think it's like the war is over and, oh, American troops are coming home. Well, back in Iraq, everything for years to come was just unraveling, continuing to unravel. You had all these tribal fights still going on. You had a civil war. You had ISIS coming into play. And everyone, the American troops are leaving. And suddenly in this vacuum are all these other people who come in and continue the fight. And the world for the average, for all these Iraqis that are just sort of forgotten, that they're in these towns that are just being destroyed and their livelihoods have been destroyed. And so where Nuri started with the camera to document the victims and to really showcase what was happening and the displacement of people, he ends up becoming one of the very types of people that he's documenting. And I think it was just, it was sad. So it's not like a great documentary, but I think it's still, it's distressing, but it puts our own problems in perspective. So I think I said, you know, first world problems seem so stupid when you're watching this, the dangers that these regular people are facing every day and the bloodshed. You see a lot of dead bodies and you don't see the enemy. It's like an invisible enemy in this film. And so it's just a quiet documentary. It just slowly unfolds and Nuri is narrating his own story. You don't need any additional voiceover or narration really, but it just provides this very unique and important perspective that I think, as was pointed out in the Washington Post review, that it's timely to kind of take note of the refugee crisis and the impact that continued bloodshed and war overseas. Just because we don't see it every day doesn't mean it's not happening.
Compared to Nuri and his family, we do not have problems.
No.
We just don't. I like how you said the faceless or the enemy, you never see them. The closest he's at the hospital and he can hear the artillery. Some bullets actually pierce the windows and come into the hospital. So I assume the day he evacuated, ISIS probably rolled in. And, you know, I was getting a little anxious, like, wow, Nuri, I can't believe you're still in the village. Let's get going, brother. Yeah. And I could see why he didn't want to go, because water becomes a problem. They're in the desert. They're in Diyala province. I've flown over Diyala before in a helicopter, and I've looked down and was like, ooh, I don't want to live there. It's there's no water down there. But, yeah, Nowhere to Hide is one of the better documentaries of the year, but it really is affecting some people out there, and I can see why. I'm not going to argue with them, why did you feel this so inherently, and I didn't. But no, I just didn't. But it's not bad. You know, it's political.
Solid. It's a solid documentary.
It's more real, really, than anything else out there.
Absolutely. And I think that's why it's worth the watch if you find it. It's not necessarily, I don't think it's the kind of film that you're really going to want to go into a theater necessarily and see. But it's a good one if you're studying any of this stuff, if you're trying to understand what's going on. With all the fighting and how these innocent people just kind of get stuck. And it was just compelling. It wasn't great. I wasn't like over the moon with it. It reminded me a bit of like all the White Helmets kind of documentaries that we were watching.
A couple of those, yeah.
Yeah. And so I kind of feel like it was striving to get to that level, and it didn't quite, it didn't have the narrative that would make it quite as compelling as some of those, but overall, especially given the number of documentaries that we've seen in the past couple of months, this one ranks up there as a very strong one.
Well, that was the point of the podcast where Hannah would say, oh my God, it's time for the French film.
That's right. Oh my God, it's time for the French film.
We have one of those this week, and it's called Mocha. It's based on a novel. When I saw the author of the novel, I was like, I've seen that name before. And I don't think you probably didn't look it up, but I bet you know what she's written. Her name is Tatiana Desronais. She wrote Mocha in 2009, but 2 years before that, she wrote a very famous novel that hopped the pond and probably became everyone's book club favorite and was made into a film.
Okay, I'm stumped.
Sarah's Key.
Oh God, that was brutal to watch. Talk about brutal.
She wrote Sarah's Key.
Okay.
So Mocha is not a World War II story. It's a lady in Switzerland, just a normal middle-aged housewife. Her teenage son is struck by a fancy car. They don't know if it's a BMW or Mercedes, but he's struck by a car, and he dies. It's a hit and run. They don't know who did it. And what's nebulous is I actually don't know how much time had passed. Mm-hmm. When the movie starts, has it been a week? Has it been 6 months? I can't tell. She finally snaps out of whatever nervous breakdown she had. We're talking about the mother here. She's played by Emmanuelle Davos, very famous French actress. And she does the investigation herself. She says the police are slow-footed. She hires a private investigator to help her out. And she goes across the border from Switzerland into France. And she thinks she finds the family who did it. And she inserts herself into their life. She thinks she found the car, and the car's for sale.
The mocha-colored car, thus the title Mocha.
Is that what I was trying to connect it?
Yeah.
And I couldn't figure out why she called it Mocha.
Yeah, I think
the color of the car?
I think that was supposed to refer to the coffee color of the car.
She becomes friends with the mom in the family. Natalie Bai is the actress's name. And, you know, I'm going to call this a middling film. It didn't hit me. I could see it is dramatic. I could see why some people would walk away with this going, oh, man, I feel shattered. It didn't shatter me. It's a thriller. It's very suspenseful. She has a gun at one point, but meh.
Yeah, and I think calling it a thriller is a stretch. You know, it's a moody psychological drama revenge movie that does not quite rise to the level of our favorite French film, Elle, with Isabelle Huppert.
Oh, I tweeted that right afterwards. Yeah. Mocha would be so much better if Isabelle Huppert was either of these women.
Well, the difference between this movie and Elle is that, and I didn't particularly,
you didn't even
like Elle. But the difference, but Elle had dramatic twists and turns that were bizarre.
That's one way to say it.
But it had some movement. And this one is really ultimately, I think, about the relationship between these two women, the mom, the woman who lost her son, and this woman that she, whether she pretends to befriend or really has befriended, who she thinks is somehow involved in her son's hit and run. It's those two actresses are very, they're good. They're very strong French actresses. And so I think just like with The Journey, where those two leads made it work on a pretty decent scale, it's kind of the same with this. I mean, I stuck it out. You know me. There are tons of times where these movies in French with English subtitles, if I'm not into it within 15 minutes, I'm probably not getting through it. And I stuck it out. And it's what probably, it's sort of a bittersweet ending. And the reason you probably were just sort of meh on it is because, unlike most of the French films that you make me watch, it's not like this tragic, bizarre ending that a lot of these other French films often have. It's bittersweet, and it's a just a more conventional ending in its own sort of way compared to something like Elle.
But there's a twist, and it's not so much of a twist because if you're any sort of movie goer, you can see it coming.
Yes, I totally could see it coming. And it was totally French in the way that you also, one of the things that was telegraphed is, any one of these people could end up sleeping. And so, sure enough, you know, you're like, all right, is she going to cheat on her husband with the other one's husband or boyfriend? And so it was just typical French in that there didn't seem to be any real desire to remain monogamous in any of these relationships. And then there's like some drug dealer, smuggler type guy that's interjected in there. To just, I think, try and insert a little bit of extra stakes and drama, but that didn't really work. It became predictable when it took that sort of, when it took a bit of a turn in the middle, and then you could sort of see where it was going.
Yeah, meh.
Yeah, it was fine.
All right, our final film is a documentary, and this is the one that you didn't see.
Correct.
But those of you listening at home right now can go see it right now. It's on Netflix. It premiered on Wednesday. So if you want to turn off this podcast after we're going to go watch this film, by all means, but I hope you don't, because it's a documentary that's not very good. It's called Vegas Baby, and like 2 weeks ago, it was called Have a Baby. They just changed the name, and it's like, I couldn't find this online, like, why? Where is Vegas Baby? That's because it was called Have a Baby, and it's by a woman named Amanda McKaylee. She was nominated for an Oscar back in 2008 in the documentary short section. A short film called La Corona. But the reason this is getting any traction at all is because of the executive producer is Morgan Spurlock.
Right.
Mr. Big Mac himself. Supersize Me.
Yes.
Supersize Me. And I guess he didn't make this film, but he was some muscle behind it to get it some distribution, I suppose. And Netflix picked it up. Annually, there is a fertility clinic in Vegas. It looks like one of the busiest in the nation, because of the traffic going in and out of this fertility clinic for IVF treatments. They hold a contest. Make a video, and on social media, the nation will vote on your video, and whoever wins will get a free round of IVF treatment. And he's making it sound, the doctor, Dr. Scher is his name. He's making
in Vegas?
Yes, S-E-R-S-H-E-R. He's making it sound so altruistic. I don't have to do this. I'm giving this because, you know, we need to raise awareness of IVF. Bull! He is doing this to get more traffic into his building is what he's doing. It's so cynical. His head nurse is totally against it. It's like, I hate the idea of people voting on something as sensitive, as personal, as IVF treatments. But 100 couples went out and they made a video, and we follow three of them. We follow a couple from Green Bay who have, the woman has had multiple miscarriages, or the babies were born premature and then died. There's a lesbian who has yet to find her partner but knows she wants a child and has trouble conceiving. And there is the couple, the Hispanic couple, now in their early 40s, who time is running out, and she really needs this free IVF round. None of them are rich. That's what, you know, IVF is $20,000 a round. You know, this is, and people who need it are usually young couples, people not financially ready to spend $20,000 on something like this. But people, you know, it's not a guarantee. Just because you go in for an IVF treatment doesn't mean you're going to walk out with a child. So they'll go two rounds, three rounds. It's that part of the documentary, which it does touch on, is sobering, and it's heartfelt. But the rest, I think, is sugar-coated deceit. He's not altruistic. He's doing this because I'm Dr. Scher. look what I do. By the way, come out to my clinic. I'll give you a free consult.
It sounds like a reality show.
It is.
Like it could have been on Fox.
Because we get down to the final, like, three people, uh-huh. and we watch their reactions. We watch the winner, and then we watch the two losers. But then we follow what they do. And it's exactly like, you would know.
Yeah.
It's exactly like a reality show.
Yeah, because when I worked on a show called Who's Your Daddy for Fox about adoption, it had the kernel of these really heartfelt, great stories. And they were very real, and the struggles were very real for what people were going through. But it had this spin on it that made it a little more distasteful with the way that it was put together. So I guess it really depends on, are you invested in any of these couples? Are you along with their journey? And does it give you some satisfying ending?
You know, I watched this with my wife, Kate, who, you know, this would be her kind of documentary. It's like, she has feelings. I've been accused of not having any feelings. Yeah. She has feelings, and she didn't like this movie.
Okay.
I think she thought the same thing I did. That doctor is sleazy, and it... Something's a little bit off of this documentary.
So what was the point of it? Like, what are we supposed to get out of this documentary?
You're supposed to be rooting for these people having IVF, and he touches on it in one line. He's like, I wish I didn't have to charge $20,000. This should be covered by insurance. And IVF is usually very routinely not covered by insurance. Only 8 states cover it. The rest is, you know, this is elective. You don't need this. So they don't, it's up to the patients to shoulder the cost. That would have been a huge sub-theme, I think, would have made this documentary a lot stronger. So this is, you know, it's not a trend yet, but this is the second film we've covered from Netflix. I urge you, since you probably haven't seen it yet, to go back and see Okja instead, which is still one of the year's top 5 films, and completely ignore Vegas Baby.
So don't take a gamble. It's not worth the risk to go with Vegas Baby.
Kind of
rolling the dice on that one. Sorry.
All right. Well, I just want to end by reminding you of what I firmly believe is this week's strongest and best film, which is The Journey.
Spider-Man. Oh, I'm sorry.
I see what you did there. Spider-Man.
Keep going.
The Journey. You don't think you like it, but it worked. No, it's The Journey.
Spider-Man's Journey Home.
No, it's Spider-Man's Journey to Homecoming. Like, I don't care about a 15-year-old's problems.
I wouldn't even begin to be able to bet with you on just how much bigger and how much more money Spider-Man Homecoming will make.
We've thought about this before.
Versus The Journey. I can't even...
Money does not equal quality.
Exponential. There's not even enough exponential components to be able to put into
a bet. Do you see what you're doing right now? You're lending credence to the fact that if it makes more money,
it's better. No.
It's what it sounds like you're doing.
It's the better movie. It's like if you are going to the theater for that combination of escapism and entertainment, then it's summertime. The Journey
We have a summertime movie every weekend.
Movie.
Take a break from summertime movies.
I just don't think this is one that has to be seen on the big screen. Something like Spider-Man Homecoming really needs the big screen effect. I think I saw it in IMAX. The Journey, you can watch on an iPad and still get the gist and still appreciate it for what it is. So I agree that it's good, but I would not put it above Spider-Man as the film to see this week, if you like superhero stuff. So granted, if this is just not a genre
I guarantee you, the people that listen to this podcast would be more likely to enjoy The Journey over Spider-Man.
I don't know. I think it's a toss-up, but depends who's listening. Let us know if anyone's out there. But I would say, I think The Journey is definitely a second for me. So I would say Spider-Man, The Journey, Nowhere to Hide, Mocha, and then I don't know, you'd have to decide whether Vegas Baby or The Little Hours.
Oh, The Little Hours is much better than Vegas Baby.
Okay. So I'd put it in that order, and I just think there are some movies that deserve to be seen on the big screen and others that can go into the Netflix queue that I think a lot of our listeners have.
Just because it's a drama and has two people talking doesn't mean it doesn't deserve to be seen on the big screen.
If you liked watching Fences on the big screen, then The Journey would be something you would want to watch on the big screen too. I'm just saying it is a play on the big screen. It is a play put into a movie much the way Fences was. And so you have to, if you're in the mood for that style of film, then sure, go catch it in the theater.
The moral of the story here, folks, is some reviewers, some critics are just blinded by blockbusters, and they can't see through the advertising. They just can't see through it.
I'm not blinded by blockbusters at all. And but would I say that I don't think Spider-Man is better than Wonder Woman? And we've seen some in recent weeks that I've put up there that have been a little more off the beaten path. Have been.
I love how we get reluctant sometimes to agree. You're right. Reluctant. This was the best movie, but I hate to admit it.
But but in this case, you're wrong. In this case, you really are wrong. I don't think The Journey is the best movie coming out this week. I think it's a solid art house option. And then Spider-Man is your only big blockbuster option if you've already seen.
I think they made a solid Wonder Woman. Blinded
just please
by
don't.
The
but I hate to tell you, I mean, I can't even. It's amazing how many people I know have gone and enjoyed Despicable Me 3.
Ugh.
So it just goes to show that there are certain movies that even though I think because we see so many and we are able to put them into a different perspective, people who only go and see a particular, one movie or they have to go see that kids movie, they're enjoying it for, just for the kids' enjoyment. But the fact that Despicable Me is doing as well as it has is kind of an injustice because I thought that movie was pretty dreadful.
It is an injustice. It's terrible. It's despicable. All right. Well, on behalf of the Cinema Clash, I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend at RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.